The label on the meat package reads, "Product of USA," but the meat in the package could have come from Australia, Brazil, or China, and be from one of one animal or hundreds of animals. This leads us to ask, should government be forced to accommodate local food farms?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,406th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Luzon who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, consider Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. When we buy a package of hamburger meat from the big box store, hamburger might well have come from Australia, Brazil, or China. And it might be from one animal or from many animals, and be processed by one of the nation's big four meat packers, Tyson, JBS, Cargill, and Smithfield, as they now control 85% of the nation's beef. Though we once lived very close to the source of our food, we are now likely to live thousands of miles away. And as a consequence, we now have very little control over what's in our food, and must therefore rely on others, many others, to guarantee the safety and indeed the efficacy of the food we eat. Some are happy with this extended food chain, as it provides sustenance that is both cheap and convenient. But others are not so happy, and they would prefer to eat what they consider to be real food grown from real soil by real farmers. The unhappy ones among us lead us to ask, should government be forced to accommodate local food farms? Well, let's ask Judith McGeary, who is the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Welcome back, Judy.
Thank you so much for having me on, Michael.
Good to have you back. Now, that you are the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance suggests that government might be so accommodating to local food farms. Is that true?
I'd say yes, but I'd also want to immediately kind of pivot on the way we're phrasing the question here. Rather than talking about the government accommodating, because when we talk about accommodating, it's a we're sort of doing something special as a favor, really, is the implications of the accommodation.
Yes.
And really, I think the question is, what is the appropriate role of government in our food system? Because there is certainly a place for government in food safety regulation.
Right.
And the way you teed up the very beginning, I think, is precisely the classic example of where we want to see government regulations, where you've got food coming in from other countries or even within this country, but big conglomerates, thousands of animals processed in a day, a really complex, profit-driven, unaccountable supply chain. Yeah, absolutely. Government regulation needs to be happening there. Does it need to be happening when it's a small-scale local transaction with full transparency and accountability?
Yes.
And my answer is no. That's not where we need government involvement.
Well, and with respect to that, government does accommodate that giant food chain system wherein we eat food from all over the world jumbled together in fancy plastic wrapping. It does accommodate that, but does it accommodate to the extent you want it, that local food system, by allowing it you the freedom to do what you need to do to survive and prosper? It doesn't.
Not at all. I mean, actually, I flip between using two different terms. I often talk about scale appropriate regulation, which is what we're aiming for. And where we are is scale biased. It's not even that there's sort of a neutral set of regulations that govern, you know, this big extreme complex system you're talking about versus the local. The regulations have deeply embedded inherent biases against small local foods. And so it's going, it's putting, not only not accommodating, it's affirmatively discriminating against our local.
Well, whenever we talk about how small farmers and ranchers are bullied by big business and big government. In what ways do you see that playing out for small farmers, for local food farmers?
Which example do we pick out of this? It's so deeply embedded. And let's stay on meat processing, since that's the focus for today. I have, a member who set up an inspected meat processor. So trying to follow all of the regs, do it the way the big guys do it on a sort of small, not micro, but sort of small regional, level. He has the worst time trying to get an inspector out there.
Who, if you're a meat inspector in the big city, like, hey, what do you want to go out there for? I mean, that's a 6-hour drive and blah, blah, blah.
It's not personal even. I mean, when they're out there, he's got a perfectly good relationship with them. But when the government agencies are looking at how to allocate their resources.
There you go.
X number of inspectors on this budget. Do they send that inspector out to a meat processor where, again, they're processing, 300 cows in an hour? And, there's thousands of animals getting processed that day. Or do they send it out to this small regional processor where maybe it's 150 cows that the whole day, 200 cows the whole day? From a government resource perspective, it makes sense to prioritize the big meat packers and leave the smaller guys to sort of, to the extent we can get you an inspector, we will. But he can't just with an inspector. If he doesn't inspect you, yes.
The question then does have some relevance. If we don't force the government to accommodate local food farms, will they accommodate local food farms?
Absolutely not. I mean, it's going to be a mix of both just really the pragmatics of it, it's easier and simpler and more cost effective to focus on a handful of large scale operations. And that's true whether it's meat or vegetable processing or any of this. And we do get to some degree, and this isn't every inspector or every division at all, but there is a reality of a natural, also a significant bias. Personal bias against small local foods. And that's because you've got the revolving door between the agencies and the big business. So, they've either come, a lot of the, particularly the more senior personnel who set the decisions, who set the priorities for the agencies, have come out of one of the big agribusiness entities. They're looking at big agribusiness entities or both. We call it a revolving door for a reason. It just keeps going and going and going.
So big government and big business have all of the reasons in the world to work with each other and support each other. And in that support, there's really no room for local food farms.
I guess.
And so, what to do?
I'm going to share one more thing before we get to what to do, because of course, what to do is incredibly important. But this was years ago, and I was on an advisory committee for USDA. And I was one of three sort of smaller, holistic oriented, regen ag oriented producers at the table, and, 17 big agribusiness and government official. But hey, there were three of us. Actually, was not a bad ratio compared to how it often is.
Well, I usually get stuck when I'm only one and everybody else is on the other side.
We worked hard to get three of our people to that table. It took a lot of work to get three people at the table. But we were arguing over, you know, a poultry issue. And I went to the guy that I can't remember if he was a vet for Tyson or for Pilgrim's Pride. I don't remember which of the big guys he was, but he was a vet for one of them. And we worked out a deal, actually. I mean, we worked out sort of a deal. And so I presented it to the committee and everyone immediately looks to him like, hey, are you OK with this poultry? And he said, and this isn't an exact quote, but it's pretty close. I mean, it was pretty close to a quote that really their preference would be that there was no such thing as backyard poultry. That the only poultry being raised in this country was in, you know, one of the big operations. But since they know they can't really stop backyard poultry completely, you know, he was okay with this deal because it was going to actually prevent a bigger black market in situations, but he saw the problems with creating more of a black market. And we're a public record here. I mean, if I went and hunted, it could, you know, maybe the records are too old. They may have stashed them by now. But I mean, this was being recorded, transcribed, open records, and he didn't even blush. Like, there was no concept that this was something that was in any way odd statement for him just to be completely on record saying, yeah, we wish there was no such thing as people owning their own poultry and raising their own poultry.
And with it, he has, and government has, at their disposal, rules, regulation, legislation, and taxation to make sure that there is no such thing as a black market for local meat.
Well, you can never get rid of a black market. But the thing is, black market is by its nature extremely limited. So, yeah, we've got people right now who are processing and selling meat or under arrangements that are illegal, that are effectively black market arrangements. And it happens. But it's inherently limited because you have to, let's say you're the farmer in that situation, you have to be willing, first of all, to take the risk that you're going to get shut down and fined and penalized, that you can't really openly advertise what you're doing. So it's hard to find customers. There's always that uncertainty and inability to plan ahead because at any moment the ground could shift under you. So they can't actually shut down the black market. Right? I think the experience in this country is at some point you can't completely shut down a black market. That's reality. But by making it black market, you certainly can minimize the number of people who are going to be involved.
And in doing so, you can keep the competition to an absolute minimum if you're a giant corporation. And in keeping the competition to an absolute minimum, you can guarantee your marketplace to the extent that it's possible to do so. And so we're facing a situation where big government and big business are always going to be opposed to you and to local food farms. And to break that hold on you in the marketplace, government is going to have to be forced to accommodate local food farms. Well, that's the subject today on the Food Chain Radio program with Michael Olson and Judith McGilley. She's from executive director of the Farm and Ranch Food. I lost my voice there. Executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, and we're looking for freedom for local farms. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Should government be forced to accommodate local farms? That is a subject that we have on the table today, though Judith McGarry would prefer a little nicer tone to it. I think that what it boils down to is that somehow we have to force government to provide a place for local food in the food chain of the nation. And it would seem like a natural thing to do because it's the way it worked for millenniums of our place on Earth here. And all of a sudden, it's a black mark for local food. It's almost as if to grow and grow real food and real soil, you have to cheat to get it to the marketplace. And so we're looking for ways that we can change that and accommodate local food. Judith, last time we spoke, way back in Food Chain Radio number 1343, you presented the meat share bill that Texas Governor Greg Abbott was signing into legislation. Did that help Texas farmers grow local food and sell it?
So we don't have firm numbers. I believe anecdotally I've heard, you know, it's helped. You know, there have been some good things out of it. And it's one piece. I mean, almost all of these, the bills that I work on, and particularly in the meat arena, end up being, you know, pieces of the puzzle, because it's so messed up. And I'm trying to remember, I'm being recorded in there for to watch my language. It is such a messed up arena because you have, first of all, federal law, state law, and you have, because of the consolidation of the industry, even if, like, we change the regulations completely overnight, which isn't a realistic thing to do, but you know, let's say I could wave a magic wand and be like, I'm just going to completely change both the federal and the state regs. Voila. There are a lot of potential issues still on, like, how do you rebuild infrastructure? It's different than cottage foods, where cottage foods is like one person in their home kitchen. You remove the regulatory barriers and they can just go forth and do good. You know, like, they can just go with their business. Meat processing, like, for a meat processor, you have to make sure that there's enough business in the area. You being not, like, me personally, or government for that matter. But, like, for success, it's this, you know,
are there enough
farmers who are interested in getting their animals processed? And therefore, then is there a local meat processor? And then is there enough consumer demand? And so you have this really complex system. And so along with the realities of advocacy, which dictate we don't get to just wave our wands and rewrite the regs wholesale the way we want to, you know, things are piecemeal. So that's a long answer to, I think that herd share law from 2 years ago has done good things. Has it dramatically transformed things? No, and it didn't expect it to. We need more change, and particularly at the federal level, because that Texas law did as much as we could at the state level, but we knew from the beginning it was this little piece that we were sort of finding a way through the federal reg. And the federal law was constraining very significantly what we were able to do at the state.
And now?
And you were much more at the level 2 bill.
Yes, and now you're back with national legislation.
Yes.
And that is?
So there's two pieces of national legislation. The one that you reached out to me on is the Local Foods Act. And this is H.R. 5341 and Senate Bill 1212. And this is layer one. When we talk about scale-appropriate regulation, let's talk about different layers of regs. So this is one where it is, we don't need the government involved. We're talking about situations where people go to the farmer and they say, I want to buy a cow, or maybe a quarter of a cow, or half a cow. You know, I want to buy this animal from you, and I want it to be processed on the farm. I don't want it to have to go to a slaughterhouse. Maybe that's because there is no, maybe it's the farmer saying, hey, there's no slaughterhouse nearby. Or maybe it's the consumer saying, I care about animal welfare and I don't want this animal to go through the stress of that. There's all sorts of reasons that the farmer and the consumer would want to do on-farm processing. In a situation like that, where that person is going to that farmer and being like, hey, I want to buy this animal while it's still alive. I know it's going to get processed on farm and it's not going to be inspected. It's not going to be regulated. And that's just A-okay with me. Like, I'm fine.
In other words, the consumer says, I don't care if there's a government involved. I don't need you because I trust this farmer.
Exactly. Then we really just, the government needs to step out of that. And theoretically, there's space for that right now under something called the personal exemption in the
feral meat dysfunction.
But it's written very badly. The statute, the language in the statute is very bad, ambiguous, potential, very narrow. And USC's kind of flip-flopped over the years as to how they interpret it. And again, this is not a way for a farmer to build their business. So what's USDA going to say this year? How are they going to interpret it this year? So we're coming in with the Local Foods Act that simply writes into statute one of the interpretations USDA has had over the years that we think is a good one, which is there can be multiple co-owners. Like there's, you know, if I go and buy
a quarter. Yeah. I want to buy a quarter. You buy a quarter. They buy a half. Okay.
Whatever those consumers and that farmer want to work out, they can work out on shares. And then they can hire somebody to be the agent. It doesn't have to be that the farmer has expertise in butchering, or the consumer certainly has expertise in butchering. That would be pretty darn rare. They want to hire the local butcher, or, you know, there are itinerant butchers, traditionally, this was a profession of itinerant butchers who would travel farm to farm and were very skilled. And there still are some. It's a dying profession, but it's there. So let's let people choose to go that route if that's what they want and hire a professional butcher. And it's up to them. And the government just doesn't need to be part of it because it's just going back to their freezers.
This seems to be in line with one of Joel Salatin's concepts. There need to be no government between a farmer and the consumer of his or her farm products. Because we're that close together, you can see what's in the food by looking into the farmer's eyes. Food with its farmer's face on it. No need for government there.
And there's, you know, different people are going to come at this differently. And, you know, so what does it mean for it to be fully transparent, like to decide that there's no need for government intervention at all? Like we're just completely kicking the government out. And what local does, and like I said, this is already interpretation USDA has used at one point. It just keeps changing its mind. Is say, like, when it really is that where the consumer is committing with the farmer ahead of time, like, I know what I'm doing with this. This is what I want. We're going to say no government at all. I do think that's different. Now, not everyone will agree, but it is different from a farmer even selling direct, you know, at the farmer's market or online. You know, like this, you can just order online and they ship you a box of their come. So the other bill, Prime Act, which gets more at that second situation where we've got still that direct to consumer relationship. So it is very transparent and accountable, particularly compared to the conventional system. And what the Prime Act says is let's go ahead and use what's called custom exempt slaughterhouses for those situations. These are slaughterhouses that are regulated by the government. There's a state regulation and inspection process, but it's a much more moderate, sort of appropriate set of regs for a small operation. Let's use that for this sort of direct to consumer, you know, not on farm, not, you know, that hyper.
Well, that's not what Joel Salatin was talking about.
What Joel Salatin talks about.
So there's it, but it extends the accommodation to local farms. So, okay.
Good. For me, the goal is how do we set up something that addresses, you know, that addresses actual risk, you know, like if there are food risks, like that's a reality, in a way that matches the level of risk and allows the maximum options for the farmers and consumers.
Amen. And that's the accommodation we're looking for from the government. Now, how's the government reacting to something like this? Because I'm sure those big meat packers, well, four of which control 85% of beef in the United States, are looking at this and going, wait a minute. You're giving control to somebody else. You're giving control to consumers and to farmers and taking it away from us. So, what are they going to say when you place this on the table?
They don't like it very much. So the PRIME Act, this other bill, which is H.R. 4700, is something that Congressman Thomas Massey and Shelley Pingree, of Republican and Democrat pair, have been working on for 10 years now. I think it was first introduced in 2015. And if you look at it, you know, we've got a pretty nice list of co-sponsors. There's like 45 members of Congress who've signed on to this from both parties. But I can tell you, when I approach, you know, Texas congressmen about it, and we do have several Texas congressmen. I'm just calling out my own state because that's who I talk to the most. We have several Texas congressmen on it. Yay for them, because they're bucking Texas Farm Bureau.
Sure.
Which is both, you know, the voice of agriculture. And I've been told this by them. I've been told, you know, like, we're being told this is, you know, Texas Farm Bureau is like, no, don't do this. Don't sign on to the PRIME Act. Why? You know, what's amazing is like, I actually looked at Texas Farm Bureau's, you know, policy guidebook. And it actually says they support, you know, addressing regulatory barriers for smaller scale processors. But when it comes to actually lobbying in Congress, you know, the members of Congress who are signing on to this are doing this in the face of opposition from larger industry groups. They're being, you know, why? Why? There's not a good food safety reason. Custom exempt slaughterhouses have an incredibly good track record for safety.
Well, I guess he always comes down to the infamous Deep Throat and his follow the money.
It is. And it's, let's look at what we've done. You know, your comment, I made a note when you said cheap and convenient. Because I remember when you spoke at our conference years ago, and we were talking about the price of cheap food and how cheap food really isn't, you know, and you make amazing.
Third law of the food chain. Cheap
exactly.
Food
you do an awesome job laying that out. And I kind of feel like post COVID, we need to stop handing the assumption that even the conventional food is even cheap. They've lost that. You know, first with the supply chain disruptions, and then what we saw both in COVID and then in multiple periods since then is the price of food, including meat, far outpacing the overall price of inflation. I mean, really being one of the main drivers of sort of normal inflation for
months. Somehow, in a couple of months, it seemed like the $10 hamburger became a $20 hamburger, and everybody was shaking their head in disbelief. Wow.
And at different times, I think they may have gotten a bit better about their shareholder reports because they've been, you know, they've gotten called out on it. But there was in the wake of COVID, I believe it was Tyson. Wrote in their shareholder report. So this is a public document that you know, everyone could get hold of. How, yes, our costs went up, but we were able to raise prices far. We're surpassing our costs, our profit margin. We're having record profit year. And it's like they could do that because of their market control. They can do
this
because when you go to the grocery store, what are your other options? And so anything that threatens market control, it's not just about the 2% or 5% of the market they might lose. It's about when's the tipping point that enough consumers have another option that they can't choose to just do whatever the heck they want, basically. And that's the threat to big business, is when do we create enough opportunities for alternatives that they can't just say, we're going to do whatever you want, and consumers, you're out of luck. You just have to, you know, take what we decide to give you at the price we give you.
Eat it. Just shut up and eat it.
Yes.
Is the motto.
Yes.
Thank you. Love it. I have a choice. I have no choice. And we don't have a choice. When four companies own 85% of the beef, we really don't have a choice. At all, unless we have access to local food. And that's why they're so frightened. That's why the big boys will always say no if they can find a way of saying no. And so there's Judith McGarry walking into the offices of these places of government, in the halls of government. What do they say when they see Judith McGarry walking through the door?
What they say depends a lot on what they've heard from people in their districts. Not completely. I mean, there's sort of this automatic, you know, that there are people, you know, they have different perspectives and we always try to approach them where they are.
It has to come from the people then.
But when it comes from the people, when they've gotten calls from their district, we get a very different reception than when they don't have calls coming in from their districts.
And that's what we want to talk about when we come back from the break. How do we force government to accommodate local food farms? There's only one way. And Judith McGarry's got her hands on that way. So stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Should government be forced to accommodate local food farms? Well, that is the question we have on the table today with Judith McGarry. She's from the Food and Freedom, Farm and Ranch Food and Freedom Alliance. And so you're just one person, Judith. So it takes more than just one Judith walking through the door. Does it not?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I like to try to drive home to people is one person can make a difference. Like, don't ever feel that, like, you know, a person's voice doesn't make a difference. And it makes a great deal more difference when we have a critical mass. Now, it doesn't have to be thousands or millions of people, but it does a lot more when it's not solo.
What you said before the break was that when government hears other people coming to them and saying what you're saying, then they'll listen because that's where the vote is. In the bottom line, we consumers should have the control over our food. It shouldn't be a big business that controls the marketplace to the extent that we consumers have no say. But if we consumers want to have a say, we have to stand up and have that say so that they hear us. Now, you put together an alliance of interest groups who represent local food. Who are they?
So even if we use the word alliance in our name, that's an alliance of individuals for the most part. And then we do work in coalitions because, again, that amplifies our voice. So there's not, you know, other nonprofits and advocacy groups that we work with around the country, but it does start with the individual. It starts with whether they're a farmer or a consumer. And one of the keys is I really wish I could do, I could, if I could wave a wand in the world of advocacy and do something, I'd do two things. One is I would get rid of the phrase "vote with your fork."
Why?
Because it's not voting; it's spending your dollars in a way that's consistent with your values and your interests. Absolutely, please do. I'm not against that, but thinking that it makes systemic change, that it changes the structure, no. It, you know, we have to do policy work. We have to be engaged in civic activity to change the system. We need both. We need people to spend their money with the local farms too, but we need both.
And that's what frightens most people. I think when it gets right down to us, most people don't have the courage to walk into a congressman's office and say, do this because of this.
And it is intimidating. It's very intimidating. And so a lot of people have followed the track. And this is the other thing I wish we could get rid of, is these sort of auto emails where you just sort of press a button and it sends an auto email, because the legislators don't care auto emails. They know. But
none of us do when it gets right down to it.
Those farm letters. But it gets people to feel, and let me be there before I started FARFA 20 years ago. I didn't know the name of my legislators. I'd never picked up the phone and talked to any of them. I am the last person to try to make someone feel guilty or ashamed that they don't know how and they're nervous about contacting their legislators, because our society doesn't teach us this. It doesn't teach us how to be engaged in the system. And that's the fault of our schools and our societal structure. It is not the fault of the individual. And the individual can change it, because it's not that hard. It really isn't. If we stop thinking of it as walking into the halls of power and just, these are people who ran for office and their staff, you know, the people they hired to work for them, they probably don't know squat about food and farming. They ran on abortion or gun rights or tax policy or whatever the big hot button issues are. That's what they ran on.
And you walk in the office and say, I'd like to talk to you about local food. And they look at you and go, oh.
And here's the thing. They don't know anything about it. And so they'd like to know about it, especially from their constituents, especially from the people who are going to have an influence over whether they have a job 2 years from now or 4 years from now. And so when you pick up the phone and you take the approach of, this is something that matters a lot to me, this is really important to me, whether, again, as a farmer or an eater, and I know about it. Like, this is something I care about and I've looked into, and I'm an expert in this in my world.
And furthermore, I represent the interests and the tastes and the desires of a lot of other people, too.
And there's a lot of other people in my community who feel this way. And I want you to know that. I want you to understand that. And you approach it not as a, and this is why I sort of, you see me make a face a little bit when you say force, because on the one hand, you're right. We have to make them do things. The system doesn't work on its own. We have to make them do things. But to the extent we can approach it as, until it is proven to be adversarial, assume it's not. Assume they're not against you. Assume that they just don't know better. Now, if and when they prove that assumption false, there are other steps we take. But when we start, when you as an individual pick up that phone to reach out, assume that they just don't know it. They have no understanding. And the only person they may have heard from is that big business lobbyist who came by and brought them lunch and dropped off the beautifully formatted one pager that explained why they're doing the right thing for the food system.
And a suitcase full of cash.
Yes. It's about information, too. And again, I don't wear rose-colored glasses. Actually, you're right. If I could wave a wand, it would be to reverse Citizens United. Most of them aren't even getting campaign donations.
No. They
know better.
No. So you're suggesting that the art is the art of a salesperson. You're selling.
That's a good
and they don't know. They don't know whether they want to buy or not. And your job is to tell them why they really do want to buy.
Yeah. Or I suspect also even, so that, I think that's right. And something, I guess all the reason I want to move someplace else is because I consider myself a lousy salesperson. Like I just am for me. But you know something, when I'm talking to somebody who I know and I discover that they don't know anything about food and I'm wanting to explain to them why, like, you know, it would be so awesome if they started buying grass-fed meat from the local farmers. That's the comparison I think of. I'm just talking to someone else, not necessarily a close friend, a co-worker, you know, a friend of a friend, what, you know, someone I've got some sort of reason to be connected to, but not close personal. And I'm explaining to them why this matters so much.
To you and to the community and everything else. Do you think COVID had a way of opening the community's eyes to the dangers of the consolidation of the food chain?
I do. I mean, it changed. it changed the conversation, not as much as it should have, but it did shift things. People suddenly realized that food doesn't magically appear on the grocery store shelves, and that just because we're told that it's the cheapest, most abundant, safest food supply in the world doesn't actually necessarily mean that it's actually the cheapest, most abundant, or safest food supply in the world, much less that it's any good. But those stronghold assumptions got shaken. And I think that needed to happen because they were never true.
And do you see any progress being made in the mind of the marketplace about local food? I just see this week, the city of San Francisco announced it was going to sue the manufacturers of ultra-processed foods. Wow. That is a huge step. If we can't eat ultra-processed foods, then what are we going to eat?
That's a significant portion of a lot of the food system in this country. I certainly think that there's progress being made. I think we have to, and this is where it's really incumbent on organizations like mine and the leadership of other, like those of us who are working on long-term strategy, to think through how do we simply not rebuild a less processed but equally flawed food system? Like if all we do is knock out ultra-processed foods, that would be good. Like, ultra-processed foods are not great things. Yay. We knock out the food dyes. We knock out some of these additives. Those are all good things. But if we leave control of the food system in the hands of a handful of companies, I don't think in the long run it actually makes that much of a difference, because they will always go to the lowest common denominator. And as long as they retain control, they'll be able to. And so to really change the quality of the food system, those are all good things we should do, but we need to be looking at how do we decentralize the food system? How do we create a competitive marketplace, an open, transparent, competitive marketplace? Because that's going to be what keeps us from going downhill again.
So in essence, we need to be selling the world, not necessarily on food, regaining control of the food. Because if we regain control of the food to the extent possible, then we can control what's in the food. And we can assure ourselves of having a good food to eat, food that's good for our body. But we have to sell control. And that's an interesting thing to try to sell to people. Why would you want to control your food?
Why would you want to control your body? I mean, yes. I want to have a say in what happens with my body. I want to have a say, my mental health, my physical health. We have immense protections, correctly so, on being able to make autonomous decisions about what happens to our bodies in healthcare, in psychology, in mental healthcare and physical healthcare. What we've put in our food, more and more and more research is showing how much our food directly, deeply impacts physical and mental. So if I want control over my health, I have to have control over my food.
Nutritional epigenetic, what we eat, controls so much of who we are, both physically and mentally. And to gain control of that, we have to go up against those who don't want us to have control, which tends to be big business and big government. And so Judith McGarry walks through the door and says, "Hi, I'm here." And that's what we all must do, I guess, right? But how else can we do this?
We have to engage. I mean, there's no other route. There's no easy solution of buying our way out of the problem or pressing buttons and
it takes care of it. It helps.
If we want our system, Again, those aren't bad things to do. It's not like there's something wrong with doing those things, but they're not going to by themselves change the system.
Yeah.
You have to engage. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go to the Capitol physically. I mean, when we have that happen and we bring people to the Capitol, we do that regularly. We bring people to D.C. We bring people to Austin. You really can see the impact it makes. But also the phone calls make an impact. I mean, it's something people can do within the parameters of their normal lives. You know, you don't have to upend your whole world. You just have to be paying attention and engaging.
Well, you suggest we call our senators and our congresspeople, and you even provide a script. What do you tell people to tell them? We have 2 minutes left.
So the short version is keep it short when you're talking to them, because otherwise you'll overwhelm them. Make it personal in terms of so that they understand how important it is to you, like why it matters to you. And be sure to give them the solution. And that's where tying in with a group like Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance can be such a help, because you don't have to come up with the piece of legislation. We're working on those. So you tie your personal experience to this piece of legislation that we've gotten introduced or another group's gotten introduced, and you give them, here's how you can address my concern. Nice, easy steps.
I'm very concerned about my food and the food I'm feeding my family. I want to make certain that it's the best possible food. And I believe the best possible food comes from local farms, local food, and local soils, food that's grown in real soil. And this particular piece of legislation helps ensure that I can get that food. Will you please vote for it?
Exactly.
Exactly. Judith McGeary, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. So important to have farms, and so important for those farms and their customers to have the freedom to make their own choice and not allow that choice to be dictated by somebody who controls 85% of the country's meat. Give us the choice. And let us decide, we'll decide what is best for us. Judith McGeary, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to speak with a true warrior, and that's what you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.